All right. Anyway, yeah. As I've titled this, it is 166. The only reason this is 166 and not 165 is that I want my guest episode number for the Expedition 33 spoiler cast
to match.
To match up. Sean has no idea what we're talking about.
We did a spoiler cast for Expedition 33 with Jen.
Just to have extra stuff in the tank while I'm traveling.
Yeah.
Player 2 Pixelcast episode 166. My name is Tim Henderson. I am coming at you from the distant past. We're just going to keep pulling back the curtain on all of these, but this is hopefully the last of the stale in the tank podcasts, I guess, with the Japanese government releasing the stockpiled rice. Relevant to you. So he will have been to Japan and back, actually.
Yes.
By the time this goes live. And the reason we're doing this so early, though, is because I will not be in Japan. So the whole thing is just like...
Yeah, it's a bit disappointing.
You're going to Tokyo, like, that's...
Yeah.
That would be like a $300 at least return trip for me just to come in and say hi for one evening.
Yeah, and that's all I'm going to have when I come over there. But another time.
We will know if you so took my advice and went to Devilcraft or not.
Yeah. Yes, if I can find one nearby.
There's like five in Tokyo. And certainly we've just, by chance introduced you already, but we do have another one riding shotgun. It feels like Christmas here in Japan right now. It is like super stinking hot. So apparently Santa is with us.
Well, I mean, look, to be fair, I think the last time I was actually able to be on the podcast, the beard was mostly shaved off. And that sort of shows just how long it's been and how stale I am in the podcasting space.
Yeah, that also Sean, by the way. Sean. I should probably give a real name. But we could call you Santa.
For the rest of the
I mean, you got like three letters in common. You kind of, it's not an S-E-A-N.
I've been called many things over the years, so I'm down with whatever.
Santa's probably one of the nicer ones.
Definitely. Having worked as a bartender, it is definitely one of the nicer ones.
I mean, if you're going to get called fat, I guess, like the one comparison you probably want.
Is to jolly old Saint Nick.
Is like jolly old Nicky. Anyway, for this episode, we're basically going to be, we said jolly old. We're thinking like old here. We're going to look way back and try to like remember what the first game we kind of got with each of our respective devices was, or the first game we got by choice, I guess, which mostly means with our own money if we could saving up. But, Mom, Dad, I want Donkey Kong Country for Christmas. If you got Donkey Kong Country and that's your first game, then that counts. If you got Wii Sports because you bought a fucking Wii, then unless you really wanted Wii Sports specifically, doesn't count.
Yep.
But before that, though, we've been playing games and none of this is going to be like super duper up to date. But, we're going to keep this old thing going a little bit, Huso.
Yes. I have been kicking the flips with Tony once again. Tony Hawk Pro Skater 3 and 4 has hit the market. And I've been reliving my, late 90s, early 2000s gaming addiction, and it's still brilliant. Like,
does Tony look like early 2000s Tony, or is it like really kind of weathered old man Tony?
You can have both.
Cool. They've got skins. Can you like do a 50-50? Can you like do a like Two-Face from Batman kind of a
thing? No, you can't do that. But there is like old Tony skins and new Tony skins. And yeah, so it's fun. Like, this is a game that's obviously been made with such joy, and that joy is carried over into the remaster. And these simple arcade-ish titles, things like this and NBA Jam, are timeless for a reason, is because the gameplay just holds up. So no matter how good it looks, no matter how old it is, the gameplay is timeless. And that is absolutely the case with Tony Hawk 3 and 4. It's like the muscle memory kicks in. I start doing, the same moves and manualing into reverts, into, airs and chaining this stuff together again, and then swearing when I push myself just that one trick too far, and lose 100,000 points. And, it's just it's timeless, classic gameplay. And they've done a really good job of putting them all together. The only slight issue I do have with it is in the original Tony Hawk 4 was when they moved from the two-minute timed courses and they kind of made these open world with timed goals within the open worlds. So that means these and what they've done is reverted Tony Hawk 4 to the two-minute courses of 3 and the previous games for this release.
Hmm.
What that means is some of those levels aren't exactly designed for the two-minute time limit, so it does get a bit hard to find some of the more obscure, like, kind of collectible things that are in it. I mean, you eventually do find them just through repeat, and you repeat the levels a lot anyway because that's the nature of the beast. But they're just not quite built for purpose like the Tony Hawk 3 levels are. It's hardly a big knock on it, to be honest. It's just one thing that you slightly notice, especially as someone that played the original games quite a bit when they came out. But otherwise, like, there's a couple of new parks that are fantastic. The soundtrack has caused a bit of a ruckus amongst old fans.
Do you stand on that?
Look, I can understand the nostalgia hit people looking for that old soundtrack, but at the same time, I also kind of feel like the reason that those songs are classics is because they were in Tony Hawk. So there's this hope, you know, like, so there's this hope that these new songs, there are some of the old ones there, but there's a hope that some of these new songs that are getting exposed to a whole new audience go on to become revered as much as the original soundtrack did. And so I guess I'm not upset by it. It would be nice to have the entire collection, but I'm also not upset.
Licensing is a nightmare.
It's a nightmare, and I'm not upset that the new songs are in there. So I guess I'm a bit more pragmatic about it, and I hope that some of these songs, you know, some of these artists, especially in this day and age where music is just such a shit show with Spotify and everything like that, that these artists get, you know, a big boost out of getting exposed to a whole bunch of new people.
I'm guessing music fits at least. It's not like
it fits. Yeah, it absolutely fits. Like
when Sega took the Offspring out of Crazy Taxi.
No. This is skater music. You know, and it's a mix of, you know, hip hop and punk and rock and metal and, you know, all those things. If you were to drive past a popular skate park, you'd probably hear these songs being played, and that's the idea of it, right? Except you wouldn't hear the Doom soundtrack. Which is part of it as well. There's a remix version of the original Doom theme from Doom 1, and then there's BFG Division from Doom 2016 that's in the soundtrack.
So I can think of one scenario. So former editor of Hyper and IGN Australia, Cam Shea, massive skater boy, his favorite game of all time is Doom. So there is a...
there is a crossover.
that happened in the 90s.
If you pre-order or got the deluxe edition of Tony Hawk, you got the Doom Slayer and a Revenant as a playable skater. So there's a bigger Doom connection there too.
Oh, I would 100% play as Doom Slayer.
And he's got a rip and tear special move where a chainsaw comes out and he waves it around like this, which is cool. But anyway, it is very a great collection of games. The Crater Skater Park, you know, the Crater theme park sort of mode is super in depth, and those really creative people that thrive in those sort of things are going to have a blast. I think there's going to be some really cool parks created by those sickos that love to sit down and create this cool stuff that I never had the talent, the patience, or the ability to do.
Yeah, I'm going to guess you're playing this on PC this time.
I am playing on PC,
which makes it way easier.
Yeah, you can use the mouse and stuff, but the it's fully cross-play compatible. So hopefully that means the PC gamers are creating with the mouse and keyboard and create some wild stuff to share with the console versions. But yeah, otherwise it's great. It's just timeless fun. I will never get sick. And it's also very cool that my eldest, who is a skater, now gets to sit and enjoy this with me. You know, that's a great moment to play Tony Hawk with my son and, you know, play the old classic multiplayer modes like horse and things like that. And just relive, I guess, my youth and have a lot of fun. I really, really loved it. My review's up now. I gave it a B+ only because of a few little minor things. But really, I mean, Tony Hawk to me was, is, and always will be the king of extreme sport games, and I can't see anyone ever taking that from him.
You tell that to my footbag champion in California Games.
No, I'm a California Games OG, and I still reckon Tony Hawk. Yeah.
Hey, I mean, back in the day, aggressive inline gave it a little bit of a run.
It gave it a nudge. There was plenty that tried, but never topped him. Yeah.
No. Even the hardcore blader that I was back then could still admit that. Tony won.
Tony was the king. Fight. Yeah.
Anyway, right, we're going to, shuffle on, skate along, I guess. I have been playing, and I'm guessing I'm going to have finished by the time I get here. And I don't know how to approach this one, but I've been playing Kunitsugami Switch 2 Edition. So, on one hand, I could talk about what the hell is Kunitsugami, because I feel like this game came out on, like, PlayStation and PC and whatnot last year.
Yep.
And kind of really flew under the radar. But, which is a shame, because, like, I remember when the trailer first came out, I'm like, this thing looks wild. Look at this art. Like, this is just freaking nuts. On the other hand, I could talk about it as a Switch 2 game, and hearing him talk, because I'm starting to quite enjoy the game, but I do not think this is the best Switch 2 conversion that is on the market. Mostly just because the image quality, frankly, kind of sucks a lot of the time. The HDR is just an absolute mess as well. Like, I either the configuration is broken, or it's just broken. Like, it just either looks just washed out. I just cannot get the balances right at all. And that's on the Switch 2 screen as well. This is the thing that I really like on the TV. I get it, because every display is a little bit different. Whatever, Capcom, you do your thing. I've already configured the Switch 2 going through fucking YouTube videos, because, like, the whole that was actually
the secret HDR thing. Yep.
I'm literally counting my clicks on, like, two different screens, and it does look, and so the Mario Kart World now looks really, really good on it. But the Switch 2's native display, which you think would be calibrated for already, I'm like, this still looks washed out and shitty. So I actually ended up literally just turning HDR off. It's just like, okay, this looks better in SDR. Sadly, the image quality still isn't great. I'm guessing they're relying heavily on upscaling. How do I describe? It kind of almost reminds me of when we got our first computer with an actual graphics card in it, which is a Voodoo Banshee. And a lot of the time, like, the texture gradients didn't really smoothly filter. Like, they would still, it'd be like really fine dots as opposed to, like, the straight up pixelation you would get on, say, software rendering or PS1. But you could kind of see the little dotting there. It feels like that is happening, especially on handheld mode on the Switch 2, which sucks. But the game itself is actually pretty good once you, like, figure out what's going on and, like, what you're doing.
I dabbled a bit when it hit Game Pass, and I kind of fell off, but also I didn't give it, I guess, a lot of time.
Yeah, so, this is kind of why I wanted it for Switch 2, actually, because I didn't even finish the demo on PS5, although I thought it looked rad. Because it was like, okay, this seems unique and fun, and I just don't have the time to sit on my sofa right now and do this, and then it's like, oh, but if it's on Switch 2, then I can, you know, take it with me on holiday on the train and whatnot, and I'm more like, and also I'm just excitement around new hardware. This is a good chance for me to give this game a proper shake.
Yep.
But it is very much like action game meets tower defense is like the simplest way. The same way like the RTS battles in Brutal Legend were kind of like action game meets RTS, similar ish, but you're basically some special form of samurai seal. So I've forgotten all the terminology. There are a lot of pronouns in this.
A lot of words.
Yeah, there's a lot of like written story and like information about each monster, but not much in the way of like actual story. As far as I can tell, you've got a priestess of some sort, and your mountain is just that with all these villages on it is just kind of like overrun with demons, and like the paths are like cursed with this black goo, and she can kind of walk through and clear them. But you can only move so far in a day, and so you've got like a timer, literally just represented by like the sun going over a hill.
Yeah.
And that's your time to like run around and like find villages who've been like kind of caught up in like alien type goo and like free them. Kill animals, corrupted animals, which for some reason give you like healing potions. collect orbs, which is your basic currency, which will then be spent on either allowing the priestess to move further forward or assigning your villagers roles which might allow them to defend themselves or specifically defend the priestess. Because you're basically, she is your tower and you have to get her as a tower from point A to point B. Sometimes point A, B, C, like it'll be a mid thing at some point. And it is like that, and except instead of being like a typical tower defense where you kind of have the god view and a cursor and you're like clicking on everything, you are actually a warrior on the ground, taking part in that in those battles with like different combos and stuff. And then between that, like you go back to the village and like just very simply like deal with, okay, guys, repair this, repair that, and then this is completely low pressure, like no stakes. And then it'll be like one or two more rounds and you can come back and you'll get a reward for it. So it's turning into a pretty good loop, and it is a nice twist on tower defense, which is a genre like I've been very up and down with. And I always kind of like, I see some of them and like, it's pretty clever, but like I never want to hang around. Mm. Like direct character control and being in the action. And also just the fucking wild art design, I actually have to admit, like it's a funky looking game, even if the Switch 2 image quality sucks to the point where I would say, unless you think you'll be playing in handheld a lot, get this on PC or PlayStation or Xbox or whatever. But yeah, the Switch 2 release has at least like reminded me it exists, and it does. Actually, it's pretty cheap as far as the Switch 2 games go. I don't know about other systems, but it's definitely worth a shake. Just so long as you're kind of like aware of what you're in for. Like, just give it an hour, knowing what it is, and like see if like. See if you just start feeling it, I guess. Although on that note, talking about games that you need to give an hour or two or three to figure out, or you have to figure out if it's really for you or not. Sean, my understanding though is that Death Stranding 2 does get things underway a bit more expediently than the first one.
Look, yeah, it does. What I think is that the ones that are most like the people that were most likely going to be jumping into it and think they'd played the original, so they already had an idea of what was going to happen, you know, in respect to, okay, you're going to be hiking over mountains until you sort of get upgrades and stuff like that. Like I've seen a bit of discourse about, oh, you know, this one's so much easier than the other one. I think it's just a matter of, well, we know what we're doing now. Because I myself, like I bought the original Death Stranding ages and ages ago and played it for a bit, then got distracted and never went back to it. And I'm like, well, the sequel's coming out. I might as well give it another crack. So I've come into playing number two. Like I finished the original about 4 days before number two came out. Yep. So I'm like, sweet, I know what to do, you know.
Okay. Way and truly on like I finished Death Stranding years ago now.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, I was one of those ones at first where I'm like, fucking walking simulator, and just had no interest in playing it. And then one day EB had one of those absolutely ridiculous sales where the game was, you know, instead of $99, they were selling it for $20. And I grabbed it, and that's when I started playing it. And I'm like, oh, okay, I sort of get what's going on. But still, it didn't just grab me enough at that point in time to hold me. Whereas when I've come back later and given it a proper go with the intention of seeing it through, it's like, yeah, okay, I dig it, I like it. Yeah, there were some bits that needed to be ironed out, which number two does seem to have done quite a bit, and made some things just that little bit simpler, like quality of life type stuff, which has really helped. But yeah,
apparently you get firearms like way earlier, and you can deal with, I forgot the names of them, just the fucking ghosts that come out of the ground.
Oh, the BTs,
the BTs.
Like, it sort of surprised me that they changed it up. How they sort of are in the world and whatever. And it's only later in the game that I started encountering ones that are like sort of what I expected, as you get from the original, where you get dragged through the tar and then you fight a big one and, you know, can farm the crystals that way. For a while there, at the beginning, I'm like, what the fuck is this shit? Where's the fight? I want to kill it. I want to harvest this stuff. But yeah, like, you know, the mules, or like the bandits, as they're called in Death Stranding 2, they will, if you just don't do anything with their camps, they get stronger. So they get better armor, better weapons.
Oh, shit.
So it does sort of give you that motivation to just go back and clear them out every so often. Again, though, some of these weapons, it really isn't that hard to take these things out, to take those guys out. There's quite a lot of different methods that you can undertake to, you know, dispose of them if you wish. I mean, you can go lethal or you can go non-lethal. But at least if you do decide to go with the lethal route, you don't have to go trekking all the way up into the mountains to, you know, burn the body. You can just do that at almost any major facility these days. So if you want to, you know, get your lethality going, it's a bit easier, definitely.
Go kill happy. Yeah, I want Kojima to keep on making these, if only so we can force Job to keep on having to write reviews about them.
Yes.
For people who don't know what I'm referring to, he wrote our original review, which I fully disagree with, but it's an excellent review, and I'm like, I'm torn about that.
Yep.
I mean, he went full choose your own adventure.
For two.
For his review of Death Stranding 2, which he also didn't like, although my choose your own adventure, I did read through it, to be fair, it was not very text heavy, was based on the time to crate. Oh, I don't know what time to crate was. So his entire thesis there was like, this is, he actually called it STC, which I've never heard of before. It's, to me, it's always been TTC. But whatever. And that was the entire, that was kind of like the thesis for which he based on thinking this game is still kind of garbage. Which for me, perfectly, the fact that I disagree with these, kind of like shoots it down, because I first learned the time to crate concept back when I was in high school, reading one of my dad's PC magazines, like not a game magazine, like just a fucking CD-ROM Today or PC Authority or whatever.
Yep.
And that had a review in it trashing what it was calling a first-person shooter. That literally, his whole opening paragraph was explaining the time-to-crate theory, which I guess in the late 90s maybe you needed to do, especially in a print magazine that wasn't designed aimed at gamers. And then it, like, again, said this one, like, it was almost immediate and gave 1 star to Deus Ex.
Oh, what? Did that guy just...
So your argument that time to crate is a measurement for the quality of the game when somebody gave Deus Ex 1 star?
Yeah, look.
That's aged incredibly poorly. Whoever wrote that has probably tried to track down every copy of that magazine and burn them all.
Yeah. Yeah. That's wild.
How deep are you though, Sean?
Look, I think I've chapter 9, maybe. Like, I'm not.
So you've played a decent amount then.
Yeah, like I've played a decent chunk. Like, I'm not forcing through the story quite so, like, at full speed. I'm happy to upgrade stuff and whatever. One of the biggest surprises to me, though, is that, like, you know, like in the first one, you know, you want to build up the connection level with all the places and, you know, get your 5 stars so you get access to as much of their materials as you can pilfer off them to put into building roads and stuff. But it's a lot harder to get them to 5 stars. Like, there's a lot less orders. Whereas number one, you would always have, like, you know, 5 or 6 orders ready to go from any location. With this, it's much more simplified. Like, yeah, you'll have more orders going out from your distribution centers.
Well, you're in Australia now, much lower population. Amazon's kind of like just treading water.
Yeah, and just 1 or 2, you know, you might be lucky to have 1 or 2 orders from, you know, one of your preppers going out somewhere. But even then, that may not unlock until you've, you know, added another 2 or 3 areas to the chiral network type stuff. So it's like you can just go around picking up all the lost mail
just and lost deliver packages, that for them.
But it's a very slow progression to get those up. And I think it's in a way to stop people from just maxing them out because, you know, with a lot of these things, you get upgrades, you know, of items as you're progressing through them. And some
people
of them
were min-maxing a bit too hard.
Exactly. Like, you know, in number one, when I got the first exoskeleton, you know, it's like, boom, within about, like, I just focused on pumping everything I could for that person. So bang, I had the level three very quickly. Now I've got to work for it. And it's obvious, it's generally for most of them a while until you actually get the thing. And some of them, you've got to do quite a lot of deliveries to get that five star connection level.
Well, two things I want to know actually. One, and they're both based on Steve's experience to a degree. One is he seemed to talk about like you'd basically go from fucking Threadbow to like Uluru. Like it'd be like snow and then just red dirt.
Oh, look, it is. Obviously, you can't have something to scale. I do find myself wondering, okay, why have we suddenly got a gigantic mountain in the middle of Australia? You know, if they were going to have it, you would think that maybe having it, you know, sort of representing where, you know, Threadbow is and stuff. But then again, you know, the mountainous section was a big part of Death Stranding 1, you know, it's a completely different biome with different challenges and
Death
stuff.
Death Stranding with the perfect... The Nullarbor Plains would be the worst possible. the worst possible place to set it in.
The road from Sydney to Adelaide. You get that one
just
little
like
bit of mountains at the start.
Counter, and then, like,
yeah. Yeah. And I think it's just one of those sort of, you know, gamification things where it's like, well, look, we need to... You know, the mountain is a significant biome in the series sort of thing and all those challenges. So they're sort of, you know, a bit of creative shit. My brain is gone. It's been a long day at work.
Creative license.
License.
Yes, liberty. Creative license. That is the term I am looking for.
Well, I mean, they did make the United States look like Iceland or whatever. So
yeah.
It's a gorgeous game. The other one is like something that all the reviewers would have missed out on is like, how do you get a feeling of like that kind of in the sort of multiplayer that it has? And something that I actually really liked about the first game was that, like, you know, there were people technically doing stuff in your world, and like you would find ladders and bridges and shit left behind, and like footprints, and the train would actually slowly deform. And also meant that if you made a really cool route to like make it easier to drive somewhere, that you knew that other people were going to benefit from that. And that was kind of neat, I thought.
Oh, definitely. Like, I mean, obviously because I started playing the first one way after everybody else, there was a lot less of that in my experience. So I don't know if at its peak, was it the same as what I'm experiencing now with number two? But I am frequently like, you know, every so often you'll just be doing whatever and then you just get this whole pile of text. Oh, you know, a port, such and such used your road, such and such used your road. It'll even come up with, you know, if you're in a particular area, if people are contributing resources to structures in that area, it's just telling you who's contributed what. Like, so you're frequently getting these little updates and, unlike with the first one, like, yeah, if you go into an area that you haven't connected up yet properly, and you go to one of the auto pavers, you've got to contribute absolutely everything to that road to get it to build. But when you go after that, most of the time you're only doing a small fraction of it. It's
and you're helping out. It's great.
Contributions of everybody. And some of them are more than others. But yeah, you definitely like there's a lot more. I've had people where like I've put down my zip lines and I come back and people have upgraded them to like level three and they can go further and faster. And oh, that is the one thing I love about this game. The fucking zip lines now
the zip lines are already pretty awesome.
They were awesome, but now they completely ignore the laws of physics because these fuckers curve. Like it's no more straight line only. You can fucking, there's a bit of a hill there. Oh, well, cool. You hit a button and woof, you'll go in an arc above, you can set that line to go.
Not even around you, above. That's even better. I was thinking horizontal curves.
You can curve to either side or go above. And so it really does actually make it a lot easier to get these networks set up. No more having to scramble up and try and manually climb up this giant hill bit just so you can get a zip line put in the perfect spot to match up that line of sight.
How this game makes infrastructure exciting.
Yeah. I was putting some up and I'm like, yep, okay, I put one here. Oh crap. That's down on that. The one that somebody else has put is down on the ground. Like, I can't even see it from here. Shit, I'm going to have to waste some of my own bandwidth to put one up. And then I remembered, oh, hang on a minute. Wait. And I hit the button and boom, yeah, it just curves me over the little rocky outcropping. And I just ride that thing down to ground level, like about 50 meters lower than where I started.
Yeah, I am very excited to play this. Like, the only bummer about this holiday thing in me that I have coming up is, Death Stranding 2 came out, a little bit before. I'm like, oh, I'm not going to have time to play it. I need to wait until I get back.
Oh, look, the one thing I will say is don't sleep on the coffin board once you get that thing.
You will need to remind me that when this episode goes live. I will need to listen to this show and,
When you start playing, reach out and I'll give you the tips and whatever that I've got. But this thing, I did not even you get a bunch of unlocks and some of them, depending on how you play, some of them are going to be useful to you or not. Like, there's some holographic grenades that you can use to, distract mules and shit. I'm just like, nah, fuck that. I'll just go in and headshot them with my non-lethal shotgun. But you also have this, it's a coffin board. It's essentially the hoverboard from Back to the Future that the bully dude rides. And it's powered whenever you're in one of the chiral networked areas, it just runs on battery the same as a car, but it travels over water, over tar. It's
hovering over shit, dude.
Yeah, it zips really quickly, but with the caveat of you can't then use any of the floating carriers behind you to carry extra stuff. So it's only what you can carry on your back and only while you're within areas that you've already hooked up to the chiral network. Otherwise, it doesn't really work. So
Wi-Fi range. There's no Bluetooth here.
Yeah, pretty much.
Outside of the 5G network.
But then can also hide inside it. I haven't used that function yet, but say you're getting swarmed by enemies, apparently you can hop inside it and it'll sink into the ground, into the tar, and you can just sort of hide there and disappear.
It sounds like a terrifying way. You're burying yourself alive. Anyway, with that terrifying note, we are going to take a short break. I'm going to watch a scene from Kill Bill about how to get out of a coffin if you're buried alive. And,
there's a good Mythbusters episode on that too.
I bet they busted that pretty fucking hard.
They busted it pretty hard.
But yes, we will be back to talk our first games through all sorts of stuff right after this. And, we're adults and, we have a lot of consoles and gaming PCs and shit in our houses right now. And we've had them for a long time because you probably grew up playing this stuff. And Sean is looking terrified because I'm going to ask him to remember back to his childhood.
Such a long time ago.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to like notice the pattern here or not, but yeah, I just want to talk about like the first game that we bought for like each of our systems, or the first game we chose to own. So excluding pack-ins or like random unasked for gifts, and like kind of what we thought of them, the circumstances that like led us to that, and like how this has maybe changed over time, or maybe it hasn't. I guess I'll just kick off here. So my first gaming thing in me was a Sega Master System 2.
Yep.
And I'm a little bit torn here because the first time I played Alex Kidd Miracle World is like, yes, this'll do.
But it's a pack-in.
It's a pack, yeah. It's weird because I kind of had this thing in my head. It was like, I want to play video games. I don't play one of those games where a little man and you jump on things. And then a guy in my after-school art class did the reverse of the normal and had the uncle who works at Sega talk to me out of the NES. And then it was actually the son of my kindergarten teacher sold us his Master System with like five games.
Nice.
For like $150, which was actually a pretty good deal back then. While on one hand, I remember playing at his house, Alex sitting going, okay, this is what I want. This is what I want. But the first game I bought was Fantasy Zone.
Right. Yeah, cool.
This is because Gamesman and I hope they still exist. I like Gamesman.
Gamesman still exists.
Yay!
Yeah, they still exist.
They were advertising this big 70% off sale and we like went in, but you know, my mother wasn't in any hurry. So apparently by the time we went in, like most of the stuff was gone anyway. So I just picked up a box that like, you know, basically had colorful looking screenshots on the back.
Yep.
Fantasy Zone's a good game, although notoriously probably not for 8-year-olds. I don't think I ever got past the second stage.
The only experience I had with Fantasy Zone was it was a secret level in Arnold Palmer Golf on the Mega Drive. And if you got 100 over on a hole, it would activate a Fantasy Zone mini level. And it
that's
would switch.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, so that's true. You can check that out. Arnold Palmer Golf
on the
Mega Drive.
I'm going to guess that was not your first game.
No, it was not. The funny thing is, like, we had a computer from when I was very young. Dad was very forward in getting computers, and it was always my gaming system as a result. We had a 286 with four colors. It was amazing. It's amazing, four colors. But he only ever let us have educational games when we first got it. So I had these, like,
Math Blaster and...
Yeah, those sort of things. So there was one called Gumboots Australia, which was kind of like the Australian knockoff of Carmen Sandiego. And it was just like a mystery game set in Australia, you know, so you'd learn things about Australia. But we finally convinced him to let me buy a game for it. And it was Double Dragon.
That's not a game I would associate with PC, okay?
Yeah, no, there was a PC port of Double Dragon and picked it up at Harvey Norman because I was in Port Macquarie and it's literally the only place you could buy games at was Harvey Norman back then. And I played the shit out of it. I got to the
perspective here. I'm guessing you were playing this on a keyboard as well. Which
keyboard? Yes, a keyboard. No
just
mouse.
Arrow keys and a space bar.
Yep. Arrow keys, space bar. I think
was it control. Control tended to be the other.
Yeah, control or maybe shift was involved. But yes, I think so. I'm trying to remember shift or space bar. But yeah, anyway, super easy. Loved the hell about it. We used to play two player as well, so you'd have one player on the WASD and the space bar, and the second player would be on the number pad, and that's how you'd play with two player on the old PCs. So my brother and I would play Double Dragon. And honestly, it's one of those things that I still remember this day because, you know, it was at the time, like I think back at it and think it looks amazing, but I know in reality it was a four-color game. Like there was literally four colors. So, you know, different shades of that color. You know, you had a lot of shades of purple and pink in this monitor, but yeah, loved the hell out of it.
Purple was really big in those early PCs.
Yeah, it was really big, really big. So, yeah, it was Double Dragon. Was the first game for my 286 computer that was before even a mouse. That's how old it was.
Damn. Sean.
Well, look, I mean, that's made me feel a bit better hearing that story. The original NES, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Nice.
Yes.
You managed to not get suckered with a franchise game. You got one of the few good ones.
thing was insanely fucking hard for a kid.
So hard.
Like I never got past like the third level. Still loved it because I'm playing as the Ninja Turtles. Like, I mean, I don't think I ever managed to beat the first level without losing at least one turtle.
Yeah.
You know, so
as soon as you lost Donatello, you were screwed because Donatello had the reach and you could go through things like the ground and stuff with Donatello. I remember that. Yeah.
So, but I do remember like I asked for that and, you know, I'd play it and play it and played it for a while and I've like just kept losing out before. Like, I think maybe two or three times I made it to Mecha Turtle.
Yeah.
And that was it. That's how poorly I was doing. I mean, look, I was what, 6-7 years old maybe. So, you know, not the seasoned gamer that I am today. but yeah, that was, you know, I'd asked for that. I'd said, oh, Ninja Turtles, Ninja Turtles, Ninja Turtles. As you know, every kid was gaga about the Ninja Turtles at that point in time. Thanks to the cartoon.
Yep.
Yeah. So that was the first one that I really wanted.
It's funny. I remember I had that game on my PC, my 286 as well. And the PC version had a copy protection with it in that it had a sheet of paper that was printed on brown paper. Yep. So you couldn't photocopy it. And had a list of codes on it that you had to type the code in when you started the game. And I had a copied version of it that I copied off a mate. And I sat there and typed out into Dad's word processor or Excel or whatever it was back then and typed all the codes out. So I had my own copy of the sheet that you couldn't photocopy. So I could copy the game.
I remember some of the copy protection of some of the games. You'd get the decoder ring.
Yeah.
And you had to like spin it around to line up to get the right sort of, you know, code.
Yeah. Or the manual on page 3, word 6 on line 3. What's the word, you know?
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Yep.
In hindsight, thank the Lord for CD-ROM.
Yes. Yep.
Or stunts, which we have to mention every other episode. Where you just learn that if you just type ST,
yes,
it bypasses everything. I'm guessing because the developers wanted to play it themselves and they got tired of typing in the fucking.
Yep.
Anyway, I would love to say it was my first PC game. In a way, it technically was. We got a 486 at Christmas in 1993.
Yep.
And for the life of me, I cannot remember the first game I actually bought myself for it. Because it came with like a whole bunch of software. I think literally it was what Dad could find for $10 at Dick Smith and Tandy, which is like just straight out of an episode of Hey Dad or some shit. Like,
yep.
I could make an argument for Lemmings too, because I kept on saying that I wanted Lemmings, and he did find a $10 copy of Lemmings 2, which I did not even know existed though.
Yep.
I think the first game I technically bought for myself may have been Space Quest 4.
Space Quest 4, nice. They were terrible though, but you loved them.
Space Quest 4 actually felt like went back and like, hold up, 3 and 4 actually played pretty well. 2 is garbage. All right, yeah, Space Quest 4.
Yep.
Which, yeah, I did really love it. Obviously, I was peeled because, yeah, part of the... When I say Dad bought a bunch of $10 games, one of them was a Space Quest 1 through 3 compilation.
Yep.
So I'd kind of just been, because it's what I knew. Like, I didn't actually buy gaming magazines or anything at the time either. So it really was, I was peeled by anything we bought early. Mm-hmm. And we had a copy of Outrun that was published by some company called Kix, K-I-X-X. And because of that, I was like, going, I want to get all these other Kix games because they came with a little catalog.
Yep.
Yeah, but this is probably why I became an adventure game PC player.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I had all those. I didn't have Space Quest. I had King's Quest. So they were the ones I played. King's Quest 2, 3, and 4, I think, were the ones I played a lot of.
On the one that note, so what was the next machine you got?
A 486, like you.
Boom.
It was my first computer that I ever bought with my own money. I saved up through jobs with Dad.
A shit ton.
Well, I went halves with Dad. That was the deal, okay. Right? So, you know, I went halves and I also built it myself at the computer store. I was, I don't know, 11 or 12 at the time and went into the computer store and built it myself with the guys at the computer store. And I ended up working for them. That's how my first job came about.
kind of paid itself off in a weird roundabout.
Yeah, it did. But they were really good guys. Like, I'd break the computer on a regular basis because I was a kid, and I'd go and take it to them, and they'd take me out the back and show me how to fix it and work it through instead of getting them to fix it. They were really good at passing, you know, information on, and I ended up working for them. It was one of my first jobs, building computers. But, yeah, so my 486, I got that computer, and I immediately went out and bought Dark Forces.
The one first-person shooter I was allowed to play because my parents would make an exception for Star Wars.
Yeah. And Dark Forces is fantastic. And Night Dive just did a kind of updated re-release, which doesn't change much. Just makes it playable in 4K and stuff like that. And it still holds up pretty well. It's still a fun game. Like, obviously, there's some 1994 or 5 jank in it. But, yeah, it's a very good game. I really enjoyed that. And it was a lot of fun back then to be able to play as a first-person shooter in Star Wars.
With all the sounds and everything. Sean, you still there?
Sean's gone now, too.
Yeah, I actually think our back end is gone. You know, we're just going to, like, keep going. I have a whole bunch of shit to go through.
Yeah, yeah, keep going.
Push through. Eventually, despite my hardcore Sega and, like, fanboyism runs hot when you're, like, a school kid.
Oh, yeah.
Once you've picked a side, you stay on that side. I had to admit to myself that the Game Gear was basically dead in the water, which I wasn't saving any money. So, yeah, I bought a Game Boy, I think, when I was in, like, the sixth grade.
Yep, nice.
And Kirby's Dream Land, because it was the best-looking game that was $30 instead of
$50. The Nintendo problem.
it was actually pretty good. I bet it still holds up, but it is a fucking fast game. You can finish that thing in a day, even if you're a kid.
Yeah. Yeah, I never had much of a Game Boy playtime because the only time I borrowed someone's when I broke my knee or broke my arm or something. And so I was laid up for a while. And yeah, I borrowed someone's Game Boy. It was the only time I ever really played one.
On that note, we're going to keep powering forward and, like, just drag Sean back into the present, wherever that is.
Whenever he gets there.
Did you ever get a console?
The first console I ever bought was a PlayStation.
This is actually lining up timeline pretty wise.
Yeah, so I got the PlayStation 1, which was the kind of re-release of the original PlayStation, the smaller kind of...
Really got that thing late.
I got that really late. I was always a PC guy. So, you know, I went from a 486 to a Pentium to then finally the PlayStation. And Tekken 3 was the first game I bought for that. Because I really liked Tekken back then, and everyone played it. And
it's hard to, like, overstate how synonymous Tekken was with the PlayStation brand. Like,
it really was. Like, Tekken 3, and it was such a leap over Tekken 1 and 2. They really felt like proof of concept games that a 3D fighter could work, along with Virtua Fighter, of course.
Yeah.
But Tekken 3 just was so good.
The game where I learned, like, consoles have generations within them. And it was specifically because in, like, Hype Magazine literally said, we think this is probably the first third generation PlayStation 1 game.
Yeah.
But I guess you should always shout out your Pentium as well.
Oh, the Pentium, yeah. So the Pentium, God, that's a bit harder to remember, but it was probably around the Quake 2. I bought both of those. No, I bought Quake 2 in Chile, actually, when I was playing on the family PC that I lived with in Chile. So that was 1998. I bought Quake 2 for that PC. But, yeah, I probably Quake 1 was probably the one I bought for the Pentium.
For your own.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was very late to the Mega Drive party. Not for lack of trying, but for lack of parents saying it's too expensive, mm-hmm. or just, like, not caving in even if they could afford it.
Yep.
So we got that for Christmas 1995, I want to say. I had no idea that Saturn was already out in Japan or even existed, and the PlayStation was also, like, just around the corner. But that was a Christmas where, like, it was going for, like, $200 with, like, the 6 games in the box.
Yeah.
All 6 of those fit on the one cartridge, by the way.
Nice.
But it also meant, like, a lot of the games were, like, a lot more affordable then. So technically I bought 3 games with myself in, like, the Boxing Day sales.
Yep.
Although the one that stands out there was Sonic 3.
Yeah. Good game.
Which I played the ever-loving shit out of. Played a lot less Sonic and Knuckles though, because I only ever rented that. So like my experience with like the full thing.
Yeah, with the that didn't you? Couldn't you add Knuckles to earlier Sonic games with that cartridge?
I think at least Sonic 2. I can't remember if you could do it in Sonic 1 as well, though.
Yeah, that was wild. That was some cool technology that they worked out there.
They found a great way to sell a game twice as well. Like,
yep. Yeah, yeah. No, I think the first Mega Drive game was Altered Beast, and my cousin had. And
so it was just the first Mega Drive game, really.
Pretty much. Like, and like, I you remember really enjoying it as a kid, but I played it again, you know, probably a couple of years ago, and that was fucking terrible. That was a shit game.
And many people like it. Yeah. I'm going to quickly try and bring myself back up to speed with you before Sean gets back, which he's just about to do. So we did finally get a Pentium.
Yep.
Welcome back, Sean. We'll circle back around to you in a second. Yeah, said Pentium include. At the time, I was calling a Pentium 233, which is just the speed of the processor.
Yeah.
What I did not understand, though, is at the time, like a Pentium 2 existed, and that was a whole different massive upgrade.
Yeah.
We did not have that. We had the Pentium,
the original Pentium 1. Yeah. Yeah.
At last. Which probably was a lot less future-proof in hindsight, but it did play Total Annihilation pretty well. Ooh, which was like,
how good was that? That was a great RTS.
I was like, this is good. I think you probably liked it more than me. I liked it. I didn't finally sing until StarCraft came out, personally, but man, that there was an era there where like Total Annihilation is this brief moment in time where that and Dark Reign felt like the biggest games in the world.
I never got into Dark Reign as much as I got into Total Annihilation because it had like this insane unit count that none of the other games had at that time.
Oh god, like there's one map that had like we just couldn't play without crashing because it required too much memory at the time, even though it was like a fresh new computer.
Yep.
And the same Christmas was when we finally got our PlayStation 1. Because that was when it went down to $200.
Yep.
And like half of my friends immediately either had a 64 or a PlayStation in the house, like when we came back from like summer holidays. I had a very strange choice then. My first PlayStation 1 game was Pandemonium 2.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I remember that game. I had it on the PC. There was a PC port of that.
I mean, I quite enjoyed it. A big part, not the only part, but a big part of why I bought it was that it had password save, and we were yet to figure out this memory card thing. I mean, like getting our parents to understand that we needed one of those as well.
Yeah.
So this was a game I could actually get through. Anyway, Sean, we're kind of like in the late 90s now.
Yeah, we're at PlayStation era.
I was a Nintendo 64 kid.
Hey.
Ocarina of Time was
good man.
The game. There was I can't remember which one was the first out of the two. I know as a Star Wars fan, I had to have Shadows of the Empire.
Yep.
Literally a launch game.
Yeah, but I can't remember how long after launch it was that I got it, that I got the Nintendo. So I just know that those two games were on my list of must-have.
Yep.
Especially after, you know, all the reviews for Ocarina of Time had come out and everyone was raving how great it was.
This game is great. It's a pretty good game. I also liked it, like, thank you for, like, unlike all my friends at my school, literally, I swear, they all had Mario Kart and Golden Knight and that was it. And I never fucking understood it. Like, nobody even had Mario 64. Nobody bought Ocarina of Time. I'm like, don't you guys, like, just want to, like, share? Like, swap games? Like, this is... But no, everybody bought GoldenEye. If they bought a second game, it was Mario Kart 64.
Yep.
Yeah.
And Smash Brothers. My mates had Smash Brothers, too.
Nope. Nobody had Smash Brothers.
Oh, really?
I didn't have...
It was literally these two games. It was like, I think maybe one person bought Donkey Kong 64 at some point. I don't think anybody had Banjo-Kazooie. Like, it was like wild, like this dearth of like all of these supposed like tentpole 64 games and nobody was buying them.
Because they were still more expensive. The cartridges, I think, from memory, like 64 games were always more expensive than PlayStation.
I mean, even
by that point in time for me, even I was starting to get over the whole family-friendly side of Nintendo, you know? Like Golden.
That's probably why GoldenEye was so fucking big. We were all like 14 years old and be like, I don't want a kid's game. Mario is a kid's game.
Yeah, I want to shoot something.
And then when you actually grow up, you're like, yeah, but Mario's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. So what came next? When you've got your tiny little PS1, which I forgot existed.
Yes, I was Xbox next. So, I mean, PCs at that point became more regular. Like, I had one for ages. I had a computer I built just before I moved to Canberra and started working full-time and those sort of things. And then that stuck with me for ages because of, you know, money. But I got an Xbox.
Did I remind you that the computer I am recording this on right now, I bought in October or November of 2012.
Yes. So it's doing real well. A bit better than the computers did back then. But yeah. So I got an Xbox because it felt most like a PC to me. Just after launch, it had been out for a little bit, but I managed to convince my family to chip in money.
It dropped in price pretty quickly, actually.
It did, but I think I got it before the price dropped, to be honest.
Oh, dude, that must have stung.
Yeah, look, you live and learn. So I got it just as Oblivion launched. So that was about 9 months after it came out, I think. But I didn't get Oblivion.
You mean Morrowind?
Oblivion. That was 360. Yeah, so no. Yeah, I'm getting the two
computers. Why do I know this better than you? This is weird.
Yeah. So it was Morrowind, Morrowind had just come out. I didn't get Morrowind because I didn't want to play that on anything but the PC. I was being a bit of a snob at the time. But Halo was the first game I bought for it. It didn't come with Halo at that point. I needed my first-person fix because that's predominantly what I played on my PC up until then. Like Deus Ex was my favorite game. At the time, still one of my favorite games.
I mean, so, a lot of people, myself included, still have that game on there.
Yeah, it's installed. So I had to get a first-person shooter, and it was the game that, and it's a really important game to me because it taught me how to use twin thumbsticks. Like there were other games that had done it beforehand. I remember that, like Medal of Honor and stuff, had done it on the PlayStation, but Halo made first-person shooters work on a controller. And, you know, it was just so fundamental to game at the time of using the two thumbsticks and becoming kind of like ambidextrous with the thumbs. So, yeah, it was Halo, and it still has such fond memories for me today. I still love that game. I think it still holds up incredibly well.
Yeah, I mean, it is the quintessential Xbox game to have bought at launch as well.
Yeah.
All right, you, Shawnee, what you get next?
Well, look, we go from there to my era of where I end up with both PlayStation and Xbox consoles per generation.
Mm.
I did go to the PS2 first, but I bought an Xbox purely for KOTOR.
Good call. Yes.
Man, I'm sandwiched between Star Wars geeks at the moment, aren't I?
It was the only reason that I bought the original Xbox was to play that game. Because I was like, I used my Christmas bonus for a year to be able to buy it. Because otherwise, you know, on the wage that I was on between rent, my car loan, and everything, there was no way I was getting the money together for an actual computer.
Yeah, so, nice.
But it was your first PS2 game as well, though. I want to know this.
Oh, fuck. I don't know. I know one of my first and one of my most loved was...
It's super original, weird that we can forget this shit.
The original Red Faction.
Hey!
Like, you know, with the destructive environments and everything, and even just the multiplayer on that, just playing one-on-one on like the tower one where you're just blowing holes in each tower, you know, that was a hell of a lot of fun. But yeah, I can't even remember which, there's two specific consoles that I bought purely for a single game. The other one will be announced later.
Okay.
But yeah.
So KOTOR is a lot clearer in your mind.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was the reason I got an Xbox in the first place.
But then you would have got the follow-up with KOTOR 2 and then Jade Empire and holy shit.
Oh, man, we're getting right into it.
I played them. I played KOTOR 2. I was confused by a lot of it.
Yeah.
Which, you know, given what we know now about its development cycle, is not surprising. But yeah, I played through Jade Empire and absolutely enjoyed that. And, you know, and then, yeah, I got into the Halo series and shit like that.
Right. My turn in this generation, I think we all know how this started.
We're going to say Dreamcast.
Dreamcast was the first console I bought at launch. And very circumstantially, the first game I had for it was Trickstyle.
Oh, right. I was going to say Shenmue, but yeah.
That was not at launch.
Was not at launch, right.
And if it was, Ubisoft would have fucked it up enough that it wouldn't have been available, like Power Stone, Soul Calibur, Sonic Adventure, Virtual Fighter, all not actually available on launch day.
They could bungle an Australian launch back then. I swear to God, companies used to think we were some sort of third world fucking country.
Yeah, the memory cards didn't show up for a couple weeks later either.
We're on the arse end of the world.
Yeah.
So, yeah, for that very reason, I own Trickstyle. That is the only reason I own that game. I played a lot of it until Sonic Adventure and the fighting games showed up. It was Criterion. So they would go on to do excellent work.
Yeah.
If I fell down a rabbit hole of retro games and YouTube, I would have a weird amount of nostalgia for it, though, specifically because of this, I think. Mm. Then when I moved on to GameCube, this is like a weird one where it's like a 20th birthday present. Where I actually was not the one buying the game, but requesting it, and that has to be Pikmin. And as we now know, Pikmin has become my favorite Nintendo property.
Yes. Yes. You do like some little
Pikmin crazy is great.
Plant people.
Yeah, Pikmin is awesome. As I've mentioned, I've never had an Xbox. Moving on, Huso, I'm guessing you eventually had money to buy a PC again.
Yeah, I did. God, that's getting... This is where PC upgrades become confusing because you kind of just built from bits and pieces that you bought and stuff at the computer fairs and things like that. I used to do that. So it's kind of hard to pinpoint an actual date, but there was always a game. I think it's probably at this point, it was getting towards the 360 era when I got my next PC. So it might have. I'll just say video card. When I bought the video card that could play Crysis.
Yep. Let me count that. Considering especially how much video cards cost today.
Yeah. I'm going to just say the video card. So I'll say the video card that I got could play Crysis. Crysis and Far Cry, the original Far Cry and Crysis. They were both really quite. Far Cry wasn't as intense as Crysis, but it was still pretty full on. Playing that game, even on the new video card, I couldn't play it at anything close to max settings. Like that thing was designed to break computers. It was literally designed to melt a PC. So I remember that. Yeah. And I remember later when they finally released it on consoles, you started the game and you got an achievement on the Xbox that said, can it play Crysis? Was the achievement.
Yep.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah.
you were king shit if you had a PC that could run it.
Yeah.
In any sort of
reasonable frame rate. Looking at any sort of decent kind of graphic level, yeah. It scaled really well, though. I'll give them that. Like, it had a lot of options to make that thing run. So you could scale it pretty well, but yeah.
But if you wanted to blow your socks off mode, because I was working in games retail when that game came out, and my Piccadilly HMV had just literally partnered with some sort of Dell PC gaming center, like in the back of the store. So I did get to boot up Crysis on as high a setting as any PC could reasonably run at the time. And I was just looking at it going, I don't know how great I feel about my new PlayStation 3.
Yeah.
The effects that game was throwing at the time were just fucking nuts.
Yep.
Although on that note, Huso, I'm guessing you probably had a console around this time.
Yeah, I got the 360. I was right in the middle of the the Red Ring of Death saga, you know.
I
had two consoles go back for the Red Ring. So
holy shit.
It was awesome though. I loved the 360. The first 360 game that I got the 360 probably 12 months after it launched. What did I pick up with it? It was Def Jam.
All right.
Nice. Yeah.
A bit left field there.
Yeah, it was. Because a friend, I actually played it on a friend's PlayStation 2. So I grabbed it and loved it. I really liked that game. So I got that and I think Mercenaries 2 at the time was the open world. The first game was on the original Xbox and it was really good. Mercenary 2 wasn't quite as good. It was a bit janky and broken, it was still fun. It was an open world destructive game. That was a good bit of fun.
All right, Shawnee, what about you dipping your toes into HD land?
Fuck. I know I had Mercenaries when I got my 360.
We're talking Xbox 360.
Yeah.
Why is your memory getting worse the more recent the consoles get? This is a confusing.
Look, No. There are certain, you know, the core memories, my core memories, mate. So, but look, all right. In that generation, right, I alluded to a second instance where I bought a console just for a game. I bought the PS3 purely for Metal Gear Solid 4.
Nice.
That was my main reason for buying the PS3. Then I discovered that you could play online for free. And that basically cemented me into the PlayStation sphere for the foreseeable future. But honorable mention to Infamous, which I picked up.
That was my first cheap, PS3 game.
Which I picked up cheap along with it.
Yeah.
Didn't play it for a while because I was balls deep into Metal Gear.
Yep.
But then when I did, I'm like, holy shit, this is actually really cool.
Yeah. That was my first PS3 game. I got my PS3 way late in the system's life and it was a birthday present from Amy and it came with Infamous.
Huh.
Yeah.
Mm.
Right. Yeah, I realize I've like briefly forgotten some handheld stuff. So one, Nintendo DS, I bought another code, which had some pretty fun gimmicks at the time. I don't know how well that has held up over time. Two, PlayStation Portable came with Daxter, not counting it. Went out and bought Luminous Elements immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Luminous does hold up. Luminous is still fucking excellent.
Yep.
And then, yes, eventually getting into high HD territory, did buy a PS3. Came with Hotshot Golf. Pretty fun. But, yeah, bought Virtua Fighter 5.
Yeah, cool.
Very good looking.
Still,
fantastic. The latest. Didn't have anyone really to play it with, though, so I really just played a lot of simulated arcade mode.
Yep.
Hey, on the handheld, I had a PS Vita, and I actually bought the Borderlands 2 port because I loved that game, and I'm like, hell yeah, because you could transfer the data between the PS3 and it. And I tell you what, it didn't actually run that bad at all. Once you got used to, you know, not having the extra buttons on the top and you sort of had to tap the right spots on the back of it.
Yeah.
You know, I put them to, you know, like grenades and shit that I wouldn't use very often. And yeah, it played surprisingly well for what it was.
Yeah.
Right. Dude, the Vita was excellent, man. My first Vita game was Uncharted because I bought it at the Japanese launch and there was almost nothing else there.
So I got my Vita I'd been at. So this is the true story of my Vita, which is kind of fun. Anzac Day. went with my football team that I was playing with. We went to the pub to do tour, as you do, and four or five of us put in like $40 each and said, all right, this is our kind of betting pool for the day. We'll have a bit of fun and a few drinks and that'll be it. And we decided to go for the spins. Now, you know, if there's any overseas listeners, you need to look up what 2UP is. But so we went in and spun 16 heads in a row. We walked out of there with $5,000 each.
Holy shit. Maybe not be endorsing Jesus gambling Christ. Too
no,
much.
No, but- no. But that's when, you know, the rest of it, like I was a sensible young lad at the time. You know, I put in savings most of it. But my big win out of it was I went the next day down and bought a PlayStation Vita with God of War. I think it was Ghost of Sparta was the Vita one.
Vita didn't have its own
yeah, it did.
God of War game.
Yeah.
It had backward compatibility with the PSV.
I'm just looking. I'm sure it had its own one because I got one. Oh, no, that's search my computer. Maybe I did buy the PSP one.
Depends on what the year it was. Like, I mean, I played
it was the God of War collection. That's right. So it had the two PSP games on it. Yeah. That was the one I got.
They played pretty well on the Vita, though.
Yeah, yeah, they really did. And so that was what I bought with it. Yeah, so that's my story of my Vita was don't gamble, kids. That was just, you know, I went in with $40 happy to lose and just happened to get up. But, yeah, it was a fun day.
I mean, that
day.
Is the rule I've – the one logical rule I've ever heard for Vegas from anybody is you need to just set, like, what am I happy to not walk out with again?
Yeah. Are you happy to spend
and
$50
like,
bucks
this is what
fun?
I'm spending on entertainment for tonight. This is this is like a budget. You need to stick to it.
Mm-hmm. That's what we did and just happened to win.
Yeah, cool. All right. And we're actually heading into next generation now.
Yeah.
And me continuing with my no choice because it's launching, there's not much else there. You would think the Japanese PS4 launch, this one was like super weird because it was like the first time one of these consoles had come out in other countries first.
Yeah.
And by like quite a bit. And to make up for it, the PS4 included Knack in Japan.
Yes.
It was nice to have a freebie, but it wasn't really... It
wasn't the greatest of freebies.
One of the greatest. But it turns out like in those first... Like the first half a year of that console's life and the Xbox One's life.
Yeah, there was nothing.
Pretty fucking slow. I did end up with Killzone. You know what? That game was actually better than people give it credit for.
Yeah, I got Killzone too.
Killzone Shadowfall was a solid-ass shooter and was definitely when you saw it running natively and not on YouTube...
Mm.
Absolutely like a showstopper. Next generation is here. These consoles are still more powerful than the other ones.
Yep.
Sean, when did you jump in?
Got the PS4 at launch. But look, I need a judge's ruling on whether this counts as the first game I purchased for it because this was when they started, you started getting these, oh, yes, you can $10 for the upgrade version or whatever to unlock the next gen version. So,
were
I mean,
they doing
I
that as early
had,
as then?
Mm-hmm.
I yep. had Battlefield 4 on the PS3 and I was a huge Battlefield fan and me and my friends from work would spend many an hour shooting things and, you know, making a ruckus and waking up my wife in the middle of the night. So, yeah, like that was probably, you know, I got the PS4 with the intention of doing that, but I also bought Assassin's Creed Black Flag at launch as well.
I'm going to count Black Flag.
Mm.
Yep.
I'm going to count Black Flag, which I would not have bought for PS4 launch because at the time, this computer I'm on right now is still super shiny and new and ran Black Flag beautifully already.
Yep, that was my PS4 launch was Black Flag and Killzone. They were the two games I got. Yeah.
It's wild to think. I mean, the PS5 and Series X have just trod water for so long, but it is as fondly as remember that last generation, and it did become very good, it still took a sweet fucking time getting going.
Yep.
And you really felt it because it didn't have backwards compatibility to fall out on, so you had to keep an old console plugged in.
Yeah, until Microsoft introduced it anyway.
Yeah, but
and they didn't,
a couple
they didn't
of years
take,
to get there, like the games were coming out by the time that happened.
Yeah. My first one was Forza Motorsport. Because every game launch, every console launch needs a car game, and that was the car game at the time was Forza Motorsport with the launch title for the Xbox One. It was a bit light on compared to the other Forza Motorsports, but geez, it looked good.
Yeah, that was a showpiece. We really need to speed on because I'm looking at the time going, holy crap, we're making this into a long podcast.
Yep.
But whatever, we're almost at the end of everything. I clearly have not upgraded my PC in a gaming sense at the very least.
Mm.
So they jump, switch, golf story. Went on sale the following day. That annoyed the crap out of me.
I bought it at launch, so I can't remember what launch titles were. Probably Mario Kart 8.
Was Mario Kart 8 already at launch? It might have been.
Yeah.
Sean, what was the first thing you got on your Switch? I know there's got to be something there.
Breath of the Wild.
Safe guess.
Yeah, safe like guess. I mean, it was sort of a, ooh, that looks pretty. Everyone's talking about it. Yeah, I want to play it. Played it for a bit, then fell off it, and eventually did end up going back to my game and beating it. But yeah.
All right. I'm going to speed through the very end here. Say PS5, I think the first game I actually bought for it, although I was actually just super happy with Astrobot. And then they finally made a full one. That was also excellent. Would have been Ratchet and Clank. Just, yeah. And it was a pretty slow start to things. I wanted a game that actually a showpiece.
Yeah, mine would have been Ratchet and Clank too, I think. And then the Xbox
Series
X. I can't even remember what came out and launched at the Xbox Series X. I can't remember. No, I was so knee-deep in games journalist mode then I got a whole bunch of stuff given to me.
Probably, at the Xbox Series that complicates launch. Things.
It really does. So, like, because I got sent the Series X console about 3 weeks before it came out, and it came with, like, 10 games. So it was like Valhalla.
I'm going to excuse you for answering that question.
Yeah.
All right, Sean, what about you? Current gen, what?
Spider-Man Miles Morales. I bought that game at launch because I was a big fan of the PS4 Spider-Man version. I actually, on the day, they were saying, oh, if you spend like X amount of bucks more, you can get the PS5 digital version of the original. I'm like, fucking sold.
Yeah.
And fell for that. And the Series X, fuck, I got that one on launch day as well. What was the first game I got for that?
It's really damning that nobody can remember their first
game. I can tell you what my favorite of the launch was, which was Yakuza Like a Dragon. But, you know, that was an Xbox launch title.
Like, I got mine through Telstra on like a payment thing, so I didn't actually have to shell out any money for
it. Game Pass may also complicate this as well, actually.
And Huso gave me some codes for Assassin's Creed Valhalla and...
All right, fine. You're also excused.
So I because I was making comparison video, made some comparison videos of from X-Bone to Xbox Series X.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm not sure how long it was before I actually bought one
myself. Don't worry about it. Like, it's the older stuff's more interesting. We're really just wrapping stuff up now. And I'm guessing now that I'm thinking about it, my first Switch 2 game was technically Kinitsugami. So we've come full circle.
There you go. Yes. I still haven't bought a... Oh, no. I guess the only one's the pack-in, which is Mario Kart.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the only reason I own Mario Kart, though, is because it's like, okay, it's packed in, it's going to show off the hardware, and it's going to be useful to have in the house. And I did not buy that because I specifically wanted it that much.
Yeah.
I just couldn't justify buying a Switch 2 because I barely touch my Switch 1 as it is.
If I'm honest, it's only for coverage purposes that I bought it. At least at this point in time.
I don't have a ROG Ally or a Steam Deck, so it was a choice. We'll see at the time if I feel like that was a good one or a bad one. But as it is, we've run super long and Huso's now bleeding from the face.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really a sign that we maybe...
That's how good this conversation was.
Yeah. It's interesting. I don't usually just start spontaneously bleeding, but I did. So there you go. It's not my usual sort of thing.
Right. This episode's going to go up so late that it is completely pointless to ask like what's coming up on the site or anything. So, Huso, you just want to shout out your socials or anything?
Yeah, go and find me at Huso on Blue Sky. And, yeah, head over to player2.net.au and check out whatever we've got up at this point in time, which I'm not Nostradamus, so I can't tell you.
It'll be release schedules, I guess. But, yeah, Sean, what about you?
Sean Hub P2 at Blue Sky. All my stuff's on Player 2. We'll see what's coming up in the future and what he so throws my way. And
I'm sure I can find your shitty anime game somewhere.
I'm sure.
Excellent. Yep. And I am at pretend beard. I would drink real beer.
Yeah. There's no pretend beard.
I also have a real beard at the moment, but this thing is at the point like where it needs to go. It's actually giving me a theory now about like Yuzo's face. It's such a weird thing to say in the Tommy conversation. But like if I am going to like just kind of get that pimple that starts bleeding, it is because I do need to shave. Just like it. I'm not using beard oils. I'm not bougie like that. So at some point, it's like I'm not washing that part of my face properly and all that shit. Just yeah.
Keep it nice and trim, Reggie.
Yeah, well, I mean.